something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, have you ever been to a protest? Have you ever been a part of the protest movement in any way, shape, or form?
I have been in cities before where protests were going on, and I was sort of clueless and walking through them.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I think we've all done that to a certain extent. Like when my wife and I went to Thailand several years back, there was some protesting going on at the time, and we were on the edges of it, and we knew it was going on, but that was about the extent of it.
Yeah. And it's kind of, it's difficult too when you're on vacation because you're not in protest, you know, mind frame. So you might say, oh, I support that, but you know, you probably have things to do. You've got, you know, the Louvre to see, so on and so forth. And I make light of it, but seriously, it's something that that has been happening a lot lately and is definitely on our minds. And we're recording this mid-November, and as of mid-November, we've seen a lot of protests unfolding over the summer and this fall. So,
yeah, in fact, just the other day, they cleared out the Occupy Wall Street guys. So,
yeah, that's right. So that's sort of up in the air as to what the fate will be of Occupy Wall Street.
Now, protests as a whole have been around for ages, like pretty much as long as human society's been advanced enough to have laws and customs and policies and cultural norms, we've had reasons at times to rebel against those norms.
It's human instinct, right?
Yes.
I mean, you feel like something has been there's some sort of injustice going on in the world that you need to right.
Right.
And and we'll talk about this a little bit more too, but it's a little bit more complex. I mean, obviously, socioeconomic issues come into play as well.
Yeah, I tend to think of it like a river. I think that's the analogy I made in How Protests Work,
the
article, which you can find on HowStuffWorks.com. Thinking of it in terms of a river, and in the same way that yes, you can change the course of a river, and nature can change the course of a river, but it's going to take something. It's going to take a certain amount of will, or a certain amount of energy, a certain amount of power, because otherwise, rivers tend to just keep going the way they're going unless something comes along to change it. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it tends to go with something. Well, whether it is a law, or a social norm or some sort of an idea that has become popular or has become the norm in a culture, the river will continue to go down the course it's been going unless people rise up and change it, unless they step forward and are like, you know what? We're not going to have the river run this way anymore. We're going to alter its course in a less destructive route or in a more wholesome route, et cetera.
Yeah, what's interesting, you use that analogy because just yesterday on NPR, one of the Occupy Wall Street protesters was making the analogy that they are like water.
Oh.
That, you know, they're amorphous in the sense that they just can continue to sort of change course at will. So, yes, they've been whisked away from Zuccotti Park in New York City, but that doesn't mean that the protest has stopped. The genie's out of the bottle. And so they're just going to continue to, I suppose, run downstream in whatever manner.
Yeah. They're like water.
There you go.
So in this podcast, we're going to talk about protest more along the lines how we approach it, like why do we protest, and also some of the misconceptions about protesting
and protesters.
We're just going to sort of jam here about what the protest is and how it works. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, we're also going to run through some quick ideas, some quick suggestions that we've run across that may help any of you out there who are planning to be a part of a protest in the future, or just, I mean, even if you're not planning to be a part of one, you may find yourself in the middle of one, just by virtue of traveling around
right.
or going about your daily life.
Yeah, and how you can better gauge a crowd and be safe in a crowd, really.
Yeah, I mean, whether it's an Occupy protest or a borderline revolution in another country, or something as simple as you remember the great coffee machine protest here at work of...
I'm not going to talk about the brand name of the coffee that was taken away, but I will say this. Everyone complained about that brand name coffee.
Yes.
Ceaselessly. Until it was taken away and another subpar brand was brought in.
Right.
And I think everything just ground to a halt because we live and breathe off of coffee here.
Yeah. Well, I remember I was one of the early protesters in that particular movement.
Uh-huh.
But I was protesting before anybody else, I think, really noticed the change. And so then I was like, all right, I give up. This is the new order with coffee. I'll just bring my own coffee. And then everybody got up in arms and like changed everything. So
yeah. And the Twitter feeds were just going nuts.
They were. Luckily, it didn't turn violent. And we were only tear gassed once.
Yeah, which is not too bad. I mean, you know, in a workplace, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But let's talk about one of the original protesters, or at least in American history, that we think of, Henry David Thoreau.
Oh, yes. Henry David Thoreau, a 19th century American philosopher. And his big thing was, civil disobedience. He was against slavery,
mm-hmm.
which was legal at the time. He was against the U.S. War with Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was like, you know what? If things the way they are, if this was a meal at a restaurant, I would refuse to pay for it. So mm-hmm. I'm going to refuse to pay for it.
His taxes.
He decided to just not going to pay his taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not entering into this situation thinking, I'm going to stop paying my taxes. Good luck funding that war without Henry David's dough behind it. No,
right,
that wasn't really his approach, but he was making a statement that as individuals, we can choose not to support the things that we disagree with.
Right. We don't have to accept the status quo.
Right.
Yeah.
So, of course, they came and arrested him
mm-hmm.
eventually because that's what happens when you don't pay your taxes.
You get put in the pokey.
Yes, at least. But this is really the birth of this idea of civil disobedience
right.
As a way to combat perceived ills in the world around you.
Rosa Parks is another great example of civil disobedience. Of course, she is famous for helping to begin the civil rights movement, right, with the Alabama bus boycott.
Yeah, this was 1955, and at the time, Alabama state law required black individuals to sit at the back of the bus and relinquish their seat to white individuals if the vehicle was full.
Mm-hmm.
So Rosa Parks decided, you know, I'm not going to comply with this. Mm-hmm. I'm going to sit where I want to sit. And this is not a situation she was like, I'm going to change the world with one movement. No, with one decision to disagree. But it ended up kickstarting this. It's like the snowball down the hill, right?
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, you have a 381-day boycott of the Montgomery bus system. In the following year, the U.S. Supreme Court banned segregation on public transportation.
Right. And this wasn't as improvised as it sounds, because she was a member of the NAACP. There was... Joanne Robinson, she was a black woman and a professor in all black Alabama mm-hmm. State College. And she thought it was time to test the law. And so Rosa Parks had completed a workshop on civil disobedience before she was arrested. And she knew very well what she was
right.
doing and what they were trying to accomplish.
Yeah. As much as we may want to sometimes interpret that story as it's a lady on the bus and she finally just had too mm-hmm. much and sat down. It wasn't quite that, but still.
Well, that's what I love about that, because I think that it shows that there was this network going on, a lot of thought being put into this, mm-hmm. a lot of work being put into this. And there's a great article called How the Civil Rights Movement Worked by John Fuller that goes into this in more detail if you're interested. But this is a time, obviously, that's pre-Facebook, Twitter, email. So it's really amazing that people were able to really get all of these details down and execute very well-planned situations. And I mean, we're talking about situations that were years in the planning.
Yeah. And of course, the other big name in protests, nonviolent protests, is Mahatma Gandhi, who in the 1890s, early 1890s, he worked as a legal advisor to an Indian law firm in South Africa. So he's you know, starts off not like the Mahatma Gandhi we come to identify with and the iconic mm-hmm. Gandhi that we know. But while there, he encountered racial intolerance. He was reading the works of Thoreau, mm-hmm. Tolstoy, even the writings of Jesus, the tales of Jesus,
right.
You know. And he ends up campaigning for the rights of Indians in South Africa, and then returns back home to India itself and rallies the support against British colonial rule mm-hmm. and the caste system. So he ends up coming up with a strategy called Satyagraha, which is Sanskrit for truth and firmness.
Mm-hmm.
And this in itself, too, is based in even older ideas that date back to the Vedic Upanishads of nonviolence against any living thing.
Mm-hmm.
But his whole idea was that, you know, we're going to protest and we're going to keep it as nonviolent as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of bleeds over into some of the stuff we talked about in Martyrs, the idea that if you sit there and take it, eventually it shames the person dishing it out.
And that's exactly what it did.
Right.
And very similar to, you know, some of the things that happened in the civil rights movement, people were absolutely aghast at how the government or certain officials initially reacted. And that put the pressure on those governments to make huge sweeping changes.
Yeah, there was in 1919, the British troops opened fire on demonstrators, and then there's this enormous massacre, an estimated 379 killed, over 1,000 injured, and Gandhi ends up calling for non-compliance.
Mm-hmm.
Indian public officials resigned from the British government. Parents withdrew their children from British schools, and mm-hmm. virtually anything bearing the royal seal was boycotted. So, and India's struggle for independence ends up paying off, through this measure, and things that could not have been won necessarily with violence, or if violence had been used, you would have seen an entirely different unfolding of events and unfolding of modern India.
Yeah, the Satyagraha, I think, was obviously key to this, right? Because it just said you have to remain passive, even if you're being kicked,
uh-huh.
or even if you're being beaten, you must refuse to act.
Right.
And of course, this is the upper hand that Gandhi and the protesters had eventually using this tactic.
But of course, sometimes protests do turn violent.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you can pretty much search for the phrase protest turns violent on Google News any day, and you'll find a pretty recent example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it happens. You get people in an area, everyone's kind of riled up, there are tensions mounting, there's generally some sort of security, police or military force keeping an eye on things. It's kind of a powder keg.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's one of the things that Gandhi realized, and his whole thing was don't give them cause to set the powder keg off. And if they start setting the powder keg off, don't throw more powder on the fire.
Right. And it's not even just a protest. It could be a bunch of individuals congregating. And I'm thinking about Laura Logan.
Mm-hmm.
She was the chief foreign news correspondent for CBS.
Yeah.
You know, during the Egyptian Revolution in Tahrir Square, she was brutally
sexually assaulted.
And again, this is a crowd that was initially coming together to celebrate and turned very violent. So we'll talk a little bit more about that and how and if you can actually read a crowd and try to avoid that. So why do we protest? Why do we do it? What's at the heart of it?
Well, you can't really talk about protests without talking about groupthink a little bit, and mm-hmm. the idea of like the wisdom of the crowds, or, well, there's sort of two sides to the coin. On one hand, there's the idea of the wisdom of the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
You go out in the street and you ask what the opinion is, and then the street is going to be right.
Well, this is that idea of emergence, right?
Right. And we've discussed this a little in the past that if, left to its own devices and within certain constraints, the crowd will do a better job at figuring things out than a single person. A really cool example of this came up in an article I was writing for How Stuff Works about the game Pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
This is a game where people collaborate to try and stop an outbreak on a game board that looks like a map. And I was reading some interviews with the inventor, and this is the guy who created it, the guy who sat down and wrote out this game, planned it out. And he pointed out that if he plays the game by himself, like controlling all, say, four players. And again, this is a game where part of it is people have to get along and collaborate and potentially fight with each other about what are the best moves to initiate. There's no leader per se, not an officially prescribed leader.
Right.
So they have to kind of figure it out and decide what their group tactic is going to be or if they're just going to fight about things. But even with this situation in place, he pointed out that when he was playing a game controlling all four players, he generally did not do as good as four individual players, because you're going to have each of these individuals is going to bring like new views, new data. And if they can work those out, they're going to actually do better than the guy who created the game.
Well, see, and that's one of the things that I guess you could say one of the errors that people make when they talk about protest sometimes in the media. They say that the crowd is irrational or full of irrational people.
Right.
And what you're saying is that there's, you know, pointing to this sort of crowd intelligence that is happening, and that people aren't actually being nuts. They're not being crazy. A lot of people who are involved in this crowd are actually pretty pragmatic people.
Right. Well, I think everyone has a rightful fear of mobs. I mean,
sure.
And I think that's what plays into this. So there's the idea that we know that a mob is a fearful thing when a crowd of people are out of control and there's
with pitchforks
or fire or, you know, or whatever.
And you're Frankenstein.
Right. And you're Frankenstein in the movie. But no, like a riot situation is not a good environment, and is one that is rightfully feared by many. So it's easy to extrapolate that and say, I mean, it ties back into basic evolution. You know, are you going to make a type 1 error or a type 2 error, right?
Right.
And so you look at a large group of people and you're like, I don't like the look of this. This is going to, they're out of control. Just look at the beard on that one guy.
You know? Look at these dirty bums. Speaking of, this is another common claim that people make, that the crowd is poor. Right.
Right. Yeah. It's going to be the masses teeming out there to tear down the golden palaces of the rulers. Right.
Yep. And this is from an article from Psychology Today that's actually talking about the reasons why we protest. And it says people join mass protests to achieve personal goals that they are otherwise unable to realize. For example, getting jobs, affordable housing, or getting rid of their debts. But what counts in terms of people's motivations to protest is not so much their absolute poverty level, but their relative poverty, that is, compared to their peers. Sociologists have called this a relative deprivation, and it is an important predictor of social unrest. So the point is there is that you might have someone who is protesting at, say, Occupy Wall Street, who is doing fine, actually. They can put some, you know, fine being meaning they can eat, they have clothes, they have a place to live. So the point of it, though, is that the person at Occupy Wall Street is saying, okay, yes, I know that I'm doing better than this other person in this other country, but the fact of the matter is I live here in this city with these people, and I should have the same access to opportunities and resources that this person next to me does, that my politician does, that the blue collar worker does, the white collar worker does. And it's really important that while we tend to think of the U.S. as a rich country, the fact of the matter is that the income gap between the rich and poor is much greater than anywhere else in the Western world. So statistical data bears out that the more unequal a society is, the more stressed and unhappy people are, and the more chance, again, we have of social unrest.
Now, two other ideas that are, I think, are pretty closely related that are brought up in the Psychology Today article. One, crowd members are all alike, and that the crowd has no face. Now, the crowd members are all alike. This one is one that I think tends to be wound up in media coverage. Like, for instance, in noticing various media outlets covering Occupy Wall Street, granted, you only have so many photos to choose from. I'm sure AP, Getty, all these places are rolling out a lot of photos, but you tend to see people gravitating towards particular images. And like, there's this one of this dude that kind of looks like Andy on Parks and Rec. with kind of like one of these beards.
I think I know. Yeah.
He has like one of these beards, except his mustache is shaved. So it kind of looks like giant Wolverine siders. And he's like kind of yelling. And so you see that picture enough and you're kind of like, that's the Occupy Wall Street movement. It's kind of burly dudes with crazy sideburns yelling that maybe they haven't had a bath recently.
Well, this is another thing that comes up too. This came up in the London riots as well. Like, how could so many people from so many different backgrounds and, you know, of all stripes of life, how could they all be together doing this? This is impossible, you know, because not right next to Andy from Parks and Rec, you also have a guy in a business suit.
Right.
So it's funny because we've talked about this before. We like pattern recognition. We like to keep it simple and easy. But the fact of the matter is that all these people are coming together for a common cause.
Right.
It's not weird that there are people from all different walks of life getting together and protesting.
Right. Now, but the idea that the crowd has no face, that was another thing that came up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this frequently cited, well, the Occupy movement has no leader, you know, so they can't just shut down this leader or arrest this leader because mm-hmm. the movement is greater. That's true to sort of varying degrees with movements,
mm-hmm.
Because even in something like Occupy Wall Street or any of these Occupy movements, you're going to have people that are more connected. You're going to have, I mean, just on a basic level, think of your own friend group. There are people that are better organizers than others.
Right.
I mean, just like within, you know, my own marriage, my wife is a much better organizer than me. So,
well, just even in the personality test that we all took here at How Stuff Works, and some mm-hmm. of us were put in a group and made to play with Legos, which was perfectly fine uh-huh. with us. And another group were made to play with Legos unbeknownst to us.
And then a third group had to clean all the floors. That was really weird. Why didn't we get to play with Legos?
They like doing that. That's what their personality test said. But you saw one group, unbeknownst to us, we were all grouped in like dispositions.
Uh-huh.
So in my group, we were the creative crazies. And so we made some sort of toy that made no sense and was inoperable.
Uh-huh.
The other group made, this was amazing to watch. The other group made this completely streamlined, some sort of vehicle, you know, like with little people.
Uh-huh.
And it was, of course, it was in running condition. So yes, you do have people who are, you know, automatically going to start organizing and helping, in a protest group situation.
And then this is another one that I found, the idea that protests correlate to weather. And this one turns out to be true, or at mm-hmm. least there's some strong evidence to support the idea. There was a Columbia University study, and they used data from 1950 to 2004, and the researchers concluded that the likelihood of new conflicts arising in affected countries, mostly located in the tropics,
mm-hmm.
doubled during El Nino years as compared with wetter, cooler years.
Right. So the hot, dry weather was driving people nuts. Raising their hackles, the theory goes, right?
Yeah.
And this, they say, we believe this finding represents the first major evidence that global climate is a major factor in organized violence around the world. This was said by Solomon Hsiang, the lead author of the study, who conducted all the research at Columbia University. And then another thing, too, the Psychology Today article, I can't remember if it actually went into this, but, you know, the recent upheavals in the Middle East and North Africa really can be traced to the region's youth, because we're talking about millions of young people facing widespread unemployment and seeing a dearth of opportunities ahead of them. So, you know, again, we're seeing a lot of these sort of themes coming up. Opportunities,
right.
Lack of them. You know, you look at Occupy Wall Street, and, you know, some people have sort of made light of that because there's some yoga going on. There's some hacky sack playing. Again, some of the people that are in that group, you might point to and say, but you've got it fine.
Well, I think we should see more yoga practiced
at protests.
At protests.
Actually, you know? We should. This is a really good idea.
On both sides.
Yeah. But again, there is this sense that there is injustice going on that needs
to
be righted.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to discuss crowd psychology a little more and get into what you can do to protect yourself when you encounter a protest situation.
This podcast is brought to you by Intel, the sponsors of tomorrow, and the Discovery Channel. At Intel, we believe curiosity is the spark which drives innovation. Join us at curiosity.com and explore the answers to life's questions.
All right, we're back. Crowd psychology, the groupthink in action. We mentioned a little earlier the idea that four people playing a game are going to do better than one person playing a
mm-hmm.
game. That the street is wiser than the individual. And that if you were to poll a number of individuals in a group about a particular topic,
mm-hmm.
On average, they would get it right.
This is the classic, like, guess how many jelly beans are in that bottle, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But if you want to kill this jelly bean phenomenon, the the one thing that'll do it really well aside from, I guess, like putting a hollow cylinder in the middle of the jelly beans or something, would be to aggregate the information. When the information is aggregated amongst the people being polled, drastic fall off in crowd wisdoms.
So is that when people become informed of others' decisions?
Yeah, or I think it's like, for instance, when you can, if you poll everybody and you ask them a question such as, do you think the president of the United States is a U.S. citizen? And then, but then if you expose them to poll data that shows that a large number of people are in question about it, or say global warming is another one, where if you expose people to enough polls and enough data that represents the idea that, hey, lots of people think this is bunk, then people's wisdom on the matter will be affected.
Well, see, and I think that's really important when you're talking about crowd psychology, right? Because, yes, there's a self-organizing aspect to it. But when you are sharing data and, you know, you do hear everybody else's opinions, I mean, that's when you can start to go a bit awry in logic.
Yeah.
So, yes, the crowd, for the most part, is rational.
Right.
But we've seen it turn irrational before.
Especially if it is being controlled and people are you know, being told what to think. I mean, one thing to keep in mind with protests, as much as we like to discuss the really good examples of protests. One of the most successful protests in the 20th century was in some respects the Nazi Party. I remember the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany. A lot of that began as protests. And then the protests were successful enough that they ended up becoming the government. So
that's interesting to think of it that way.
Yeah.
And how that error in logic rose to really just.
Yeah. And for every great example of civil rights protest out there, you can find another equally disturbing, say, Ku Klux Klan
group thing
going on as well. So that's just something to keep in mind about the free market of ideas and the use of protest to try and turn the tide of public sentiment.
This is interesting, too. This is from psychologist Clifford Stott of the University of Liverpool in England. He has a theory of crowd behavior called the elaborated social identity model. This holds that individuals in a crowd do keep thinking for themselves. On top of their individual identities, though, they also develop a makeshift social identity, which includes everyone else in the group. When the group faces opposition, such as police indiscriminately bashing the members of the group with batons, the social identity congeals. Members of the group begin to work together to fight what it sees as common oppressors. So that maybe is some sort of insight, particularly into the Nazi example that you were talking about, that if a group feels on some level that they're in danger, then all of a sudden your individualism will cede to groupthink.
Yeah, which explains a lot of why a protest can be successful and also why it can potentially collapse into violence.
Okay, let's say it all goes to poo. What do we do?
Well, it depends exactly how it goes to poo, actually. I'll tell you one thing to keep in mind, and we referenced this earlier when we brought up the idea of our bosses tear gassing us. Tear gas. I just wrote an article about this for How Stuff Works, How Tear Gas Works, which should be on the site by the time this episode airs. And there are a number of things to do if you get tear gas. First of all, tear gas, as it's commonly used, is actually CS gas, and it is generally not lethal. It is less lethal, if you want to get technical, though it is also technically a chemical weapon.
Right.
And it's used just around the world, no matter what country you're talking about, because it is an effective riot control agent. And the reason is because if you are hit with tear gas, you pretty much are only concerned with the horrendous burning in your eyes, in your mouth, possibly in your lungs, and on your skin. It really tends to simplify a situation. What starts off as, you know, I believe that people of my generation don't have a proper say in government, blah, 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 it ends up devolving into, oh my goodness, I need to get some water on my face now.
Right.
And so people tend to scatter. And certainly if you were tear gas, scattering is a good idea, provided you can see where you're going and there's not a danger in running, because you want to get away from the source of the tear gas.
Right.
And then you're going to want to, if you have contacts in, you're going to want to get those out, preferably with hands that have not been covered with
clean
tear
hands.
Gas.
Clean hands. Yeah.
So clean hands being like, you know, if you can find somebody who can jab them out of your eyes for you, or preferably medical relief. A lot of protests, you're going to have some people on hand to provide medical support afterwards for individuals who have been tear gassed.
So ideally, like, you would have safety goggles on, you would have some sort of surgical gloves on. You might look odd, but
you also see individuals attending protests with gas masks, with be they you know, commercially available gas mask or improvised right. gas mask. I'm not saying do that, but some people.
If you don't have it, you know, try a scarf. That's not as effective. But obviously there are things that you can do to prepare if you think that you will be in the middle of a protest.
Yeah. The big thing with tear gas is you want to get away from it. Mm-hmm. You want to get it off of you and then you'll probably be okay. Prolonged exposure, that's where things get dangerous.
And this is kind of a duh observation, but it probably bears mentioning that if you don't want to get hit with tear gas, if you don't want, the police to maybe aggravate you a bit, mm-hmm. do not be in the front lines. Try to be on the periphery of the crowd. Of course, that would make a really crappy protest if everybody did that. But if this is what you're trying to avoid, then it makes sense that you would back off a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, and then the other thing, too, if you get it on your clothing, you're going to take those clothing items off as soon as possible.
Right.
You're going to want to shower. And if you have it on your shirt, you might want to consider cutting the shirt off if it has to be removed over your head. Because otherwise, you're going to be dragging a tear gas coated shirt across your face.
Yeah.
So just another small thing to worry about there. But then also, it's worth noting that some individuals are going to be hypersensitive to tear gas,
mm-hmm.
and that's certainly a situation to be aware of. But then also some people have a surprising immunity to tear gas.
Right.
So there's no way to know unless you have been gassed, really. But, you know, well, I mean, you can know if you have a heightened immunity. I mean, you may have like a compromised immune system. If you were a child, if you were an elderly individual, then that's a pretty good sign that tear gas is going to have a rougher effect on you.
Yeah, and let's talk about policing, too, because obviously the police are there. They're not trying to be the bad guys. Sometimes things happen and they inadvertently end up being the bad guys. They didn't set out to be the bad guys. That's a very difficult position for someone to be in. It's stressful. It's potentially dangerous for them and for you. So, you know, how do you behave if you are confronted by a police officer?
Well, a lot of it, I mean, it lines up basically with what Gandhi was saying, right? I mean, if some dude is clubbing people in front of you, or, I mean, not even clubbing, if they're just, say, arresting everybody in sight, if you were passive, if you were visibly not a threat, then you're going to be better off.
You're less likely to probably be beat with a baton or to be put in a position of aggression by a police officer. That, of course, we have seen examples before where that's not necessarily true. But if this is something that you're doing, again, you got to keep that in mind. And what do you do if a police officer or someone else in the crowd becomes very aggressive with you? I mean, there are actually a couple of things that you can think about doing. It takes foresight and it takes a lot of concentration, but you can help to diffuse a situation.
Well, comes from the book, How to Win a Fight, that we were looking at earlier. And, and certainly we're certainly not advocating getting in a fight with anybody.
We're not advocating this book per se. We're just, there's some information in it that was helpful.
Yeah. And one of these was that if you were in a situation where someone is acting aggressively towards you. And in a protest environment, this could be even one of your fellow protesters if things get out of hand. They say if you were to say something confusing or perplexing, that is out of character with the situation.
Right.
That can help if only providing like one brief moment to slip away or to distill the aggression of the other individual.
Right. So if it seemed like someone was about to attack you, then you could calmly say to them something like, do you know what time it is? Which sounds ridiculous, but really what's happening is that it's creating this mental sort of flicker in their brains and it's cognitive dissonance, right? Because they're like, who cares what
because
time it is?
Because they would expect someone to say like, occupy this or back off, pig, right? I mean, that's the kind of stuff that someone in an aggressive mindset in that situation might expect them to say. And if you don't play along with that, with that transcript.
Right. With a social role that you're playing, right?
Right. Then that can potentially help diffuse the situation.
Yeah. And another effective thing to do is to calmly say something along the lines of, you know, there are a lot of surveillance cameras around here, or there are a lot of people with video surveillance, or, you know, cell phone video, so that you can get that person to back out of their heads a little bit and sort of see the big picture of the situation and maybe even think, oh, okay, this is, you know, someone's about to record some sort of transgression on my part.
Yeah. And if you manage to make it away from a protest that has fallen apart into some sort of violent situation, take an indirect route home. Don't go the direct route necessarily.
Yeah, I read that and I wondered about that. I wondered if this was a sort of extension of police going after people. Although I'm assuming that if you're on your way home, you're probably out of nabbing distance.
I think that, yeah, I think this one just basically, it's kind of like, are you being herded into arrest kind of a situation. It's about, you know, arrest avoidance. And that's the other thing. If someone is trying to arrest you at a protest, you should probably just comply and be arrested, really. Yeah. I mean, certainly we're not going to advocate that anyone try to avoid arrest, lawful arrest. But, I mean, if it's a situation between being chased down or hit with a rubber bullet versus giving yourself up to the authorities that are cracking down on the protest, you know.
And if you're about to get clocked, this is sort of interesting. Again, it's from the book. But they were basically saying that it sounds counterintuitive, but if you're about to get struck, you should try to relax your muscles.
Yeah.
The reason is because your reaction time is going to be a lot slower if you lock up all your muscles in anticipation of a blow. So if you're going to try to avoid it, then that's what you'd want to do. I mean, it's very kind of kung fu, right? Because,
you know. Well, it's like a batter on the mound, right? If the batter is stressed out, they're not going to have they may be as powerful as all get out, but they're not going to have as much control over their swing.
Yeah. And this is, I thought it was kind of funny from the book. They said, when adrenaline hits your system, you become tougher and more resilient. But the downside is that you become a one-task, knuckle-dragging troglodyte. So the more stressed you are, the more your body shuts down. And we're talking from fine motor skills like finger dexterity and eye-hand coordination to the loss of depth perception and then, of course, irrational thinking.
So those are just some ideas about how you might respond to a protest environment.
Yeah. And this, again, this is sort of timely, this piece of information, too. In the final hours of protest, you know, when the permits are about to expire, this is usually when the police make most of their arrests, because now they can kind of charge in and do that. So
go early and leave while they're wanting you to stay, right?
Exactly. Yeah,
like with any party.
Leave on a high note.
So let's leave on a high note on this one then. Though certainly we invite any ideas and opinions related to this topic, because this one, more than a lot of them, there's some aspects of it that are open to interpretation in terms of, like, what, for instance, what the best response is. I mean, these are
right. Yeah, I would love to hear from people who have perhaps been in many protests before. What have your experiences been like?
And what has it been like when people, like, try to keep it cool and try to, you know, try to engage in nonviolence and passive responses to all of this. Be interested to hear any tales.
I'd love to leave off with a quote from Martin Luther King about this, his take on the psychology of the disenfranchised. There is nothing more dangerous than to build a society with a large segment of people in that society who feel that they have no stake in it, who feel that they have nothing to lose. People who have a stake in their society protect that society. But when they don't have it, they unconsciously want to destroy it. I think those are pretty sage words from Martin Luther King.
Well, hey, I'm going to reach into the listener mail folder if the robot will hand it to me. Thank you, robot. So this one here is from Hannah. Hannah writes in and says, "Dear Robert and Julie, I recently listened to your podcast on sports and was intrigued by a passing bit of information. When you were talking about the brain simulating throwing a baseball when watching a baseball being thrown, Robert mentioned the brain doing the same while reading. As the family's resident bookworm, it has been pointed out to me that while reading, I make a lot of facial expressions. My parents and sister tease me for this, but I have found that these expressions are not of my reaction to the book, but reflect the emotions of the characters. For example, if a character's brow is furrowed, mine will be as well. I always attributed this to general quirkiness, but it was fascinating to hear what might be going on in my head. I love the podcast. You guys make college app season a lot less stressful." Oh, college application season.
Yeah. As opposed to, like, something on your phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, her mirror neurons were definitely at work there.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, too, about the Imaginary Friends podcast that we did, in which we talked about the authors sometimes engaging with the characters they're creating as imaginary friends. In fact, thinking of them as imaginary friends. So a lot of that plays into it, the empathy part.
Yeah.
I have one quick email from a listener named Savar. And Savar said, "I just heard your last podcast and heard Julie say that adrenaline floods your body. I'm a biology student. I just recently found out that the amount of adrenaline needed to trigger the fight or flight response is actually minuscule. Adrenaline has roughly the same concentration in your body as an aspirin tablet dissolved in an Olympic-sized swimming pool."
Oh, okay.
So that's pretty fascinating, right? Like that amount could make you feel as though you are having adrenaline rush, like you, as if you were being flooded with adrenaline, but you're not.
Huh.
So thank you, Savar.
All right. Well, if you guys have any tidbits to share with us, you know, especially about protests, your own experiences with them, your own thoughts about them, and about, I mean, just the idea of protests as this social thing. I mean, that's what fascinates me the most, and certainly was what engaged me the most in writing that article about protests. Share them with us. We are on Facebook and Twitter. We are Blow the Mind on both of those.
And you can always share your thoughts by sending us an email at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join How Stuff Works staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.